half of life because people in our culture have long been supported by it. It has often stood between them and hunger. But people cannot have leaned on this staff forever, because bread is a relatively recent invention in the history of the human race, dating back only to the domestication of wheat about 9,000 years ago in the Fertile Crescent of the Middle East. This raises the question of what people depended on for their basic supply of calories before the development of agriculture and the cultivation of cereals. In recent years, a number of medical experts have conjectured about human nutrition in truly ancient times, as far back as the Stone Age, well before the invention of agriculture. In writing about the Paleolithic diet of our distant ancestors, they claim it was superior to contemporary habits of eating. But I detect a certain romanticism in accounts of the Paleolithic diet. Our hunter-gatherer ancestors come across as being happier and healthier than us, with much more leisure time and none of the social inequalities and stresses of modern urbanites. Of course, day-to-day reality in the Stone Age was probably not so rosy. Death from violence, accident, and infection must have been very common. Few individuals lived beyond what is now considered youth, so most did not live long enough to develop the degenerative diseases that are common in our times and are often blamed on our eating habits. Rhapsodic praise for the Paleolithic diet by anthropologists and some physicians resonates with the anti-carbohydrate advocates. We are told that the advent of agriculture and the introduction of cereal grains in the human diet started us on the road to obesity, diabetes, atherosclerosis, and all manner of ills of modern civilization, social as well as physical. The reasoning behind this assertion goes like this. Cultivation of grains, and secondarily of starchy tubers and roots, introduce large amounts of carbohydrate into the human diet on a regular basis. Prior to that development, early humans got sugar only occasionally in the form of wild fruit or honeycombs, and starch only occasionally in the form of wild nuts and tubers. This change required the pancreas to work much harder, because insulin is needed to manage the flood of glucose into the bloodstream that follows every high-carbohydrate meal. High levels of blood glucose, hyperglycemia, are toxic and must be cleared rapidly to maintain normal body function. One problem they create is abnormal reactions of glucose with protein molecules, glycation, that can result in defective enzymes and tissues. Glycation may account for some of the degenerative changes commonly seen in people with diabetes, such as vascular and retinal damage. Like all hormones, insulin has widespread and varied effects in the body, even though doctors typically pay attention to only one of them, the facilitation of transport of glucose from the blood into cells. We now know that insulin also encourages the body to store up calories as fat, can promote arterial damage, and may even accelerate the growth of tumors. Moreover, in some people, frequent outbursts of insulin from the pancreas may encourage cells to decrease their sensitivity to that hormone. By making fewer insulin receptors, they become insulin resistant. Insulin resistance is associated with stubborn obesity, abnormalities of blood fats, high blood pressure, adult-onset diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, including increased risk of death from heart attacks and strokes. Is it possible that all those satisfying, filling, life-sustaining carbohydrate foods that became available to us following the domestication of starch-bearing plants are the root cause of these calamities? One tool for analyzing this question is the glycemic index, the measure of how different carbohydrate foods affect blood glucose. The higher the glycemic index, the GI, the faster is the rate of increase of glucose in the blood, the greater the insulin response, and the greater the potential to expose the body both to the toxic effects of high blood sugar and to the harmful effects of insulin. Glycemic index is a relatively new concept, one that has gained recent acceptance among nutritionists and physicians in Europe, but has not made much headway in America, where outmoded and less useful ways of viewing carbohydrates are still in vogue. Glucose is assigned an arbitrary GI of 100. All other carbohydrates have a GI of less than 100. Foods with GIs below 55 are considered to have a low glycemic index. Numbers above 70 indicate high glycemic index, and numbers between 55 and 70 are intermediate. In general, high glycemic index foods provoke strong insulin responses, increasing exposure of the body to all the harmful effects of that hormone whereas low glycemic index foods do not. Low glycemic index foods provide energy in slow and sustained release form, mitigating hunger and facilitating the smooth use and storage of calories. High glycemic index foods provide bursts of energy that may be followed quickly by depletions and hunger. This does not necessarily mean that high GI foods are bad and low GI foods are good, but it may mean that the proportion of high GI foods in the diet is an important variable to consider in looking at the health risks of relying on carbohydrates as staples. Several factors influence how fast a particular carbohydrate raises blood sugar. One is the chemical nature of the carbohydrate. The body is very efficient at processing glucose, its preferred fuel, but it has a limited ability to handle fructose, a common monosaccharide in fruits and honey. Fructose has quite a low GI of 23. Remember that ordinary table sugar, sucrose, is a disaccharide made up of one molecule of glucose linked to one of fructose. The GI of white sugar is 65, almost exactly midway between 23 and 100 in the intermediate range. As I said earlier, amylose and amylopectin, the two principal plant starches, have different rates of digestion. Amylopectin has a higher GI than amylose because its branch structure gives enzymes more surface area to attack. Even more important is the physical nature of the carbohydrate in a particular food. Most breads are in the high range, not because of the chemical nature of wheat starch, but for two mechanical reasons. First, the fine particle size of wheat flour gives digestive enzymes great surface area to work on. And second, the exploded structure of bread, a result of the leavening action of yeast, further increases the surface area of the food. By contrast, pasta has a low GI, which can be lowered further by cooking it less. The al dente pasta that Italians favor, and that seems slightly undercooked to Americans when they first encounter it, resists digestive enzymes more than longer-cooked pasta, and so has a lower GI. I want to explain how this new concept of rating carbohydrate foods by glycemic index makes it possible to understand the impact of those foods on human nutrition historically and at present, as well as to decide how much and what kind of carbohydrate should be in the optimum diet. Let's go back 10,000 years and look at what happened to the human diet when agriculture made starch-bearing plants available on a regular basis. People quickly learned to eat grains, first by parching them, that is by dry toasting the whole seeds, then by turning them into gruel and bread, and probably just as early into beer. The human body quickly adapted to these new foods, since it could derive glucose from them so easily, making for better brain function and more energy for physical activity. Human societies thrived as a result, with great increases in population and prosperity. Think about the sources of carbohydrate in the diet of humans through the millennia following the domestication of crop plants. The list would include whole grains, gruels and porridges made from whole or cracked grains, coarse breads containing cracked and roughly ground grains, beans, vegetables including tubers and roots, and fruits, all low GI foods. Let's consider the sources of carbohydrate in our diets today. Here is a list of the top 20 in the American diet compiled by a researcher at the Harvard School of Public Health. Potatoes, white bread, cold breakfast cereal, dark bread, orange juice, banana, white rice, pizza, pasta, muffins, fruit punch, Coca-Cola, apple, skim milk, pancakes, table sugar, jam, cranberry juice, French fries, and candy. I think you will agree that something has changed since 9000 BC. Experts may quibble about the details of a Mesopotamian brunch, but it is safe to say that our early agriculturalist ancestors were not washing down French fries and pizzas with Coca-Cola and fruit punch. Obviously, people now are getting most of their carbohydrate from high glycemic index foods that do not provide slow-release energy and are not at all kind to the pancreas. It is even more interesting that the change happened very recently, mostly in the past 200 years. In my view, the problem with carbohydrate in the human diet is not its introduction following the development of agriculture, but rather a drastic lowering of the quality of carbohydrate foods as a result of modern food technology, specifically the refining and processing of low GI foods into high GI counterparts. Consider two innovations, flour and corn syrup. Modern flour comes from high-speed rolling mills that replaced traditional millstones in the early 1800s. The new mills were potentially much more efficient, but because they generated much more heat, flour coming from them spoiled quicker. Spoilage of ground grains results first from rancidity, oxidation of the oil contained in the embryo of the seed, and oxidation is much accelerated at high temperatures. The solution was to degerminate the grain, that is, remove and discard the embryo, and to remove the seed coat, the bran, whose fiber impeded the new milling process. The result was white flour, pure superfine particles of starch with huge surface area and a very high glycemic index. Millers could produce this new food much more cheaply than stone ground flour, and it had a much longer life in storage. It also turned out to be an easy sell. White flour made lighter, fluffier breads and pastries, and being a product of new technology seemed attractively modern. In Europe, city dwellers with sophisticated palates quickly came to prefer these new foods, while the old-fashioned coarse dark breads of the past were stigmatized as the fare of peasants and ignorant country folk. Whether it is shaped into rolls, muffins, or pizza crusts, baked into pretzels or crackers, fortified with vitamins and minerals, or mixed with flours of other grains, these white flour products are all the same, one of the unhealthiest creations of food technology. Foods made from it are ubiquitous and routinely pull the glycemic index of meals up to levels that cause episodic bursts of high blood sugar, hyperglycemia, and corresponding bursts of insulin secretion, hyperinsulinism. Corn syrup is a more recent invention, one that has taken the market by storm. Food technologists learned to make a sweet syrup from cornstarch early in this century by boiling it with acid under pressure. The maximum sugar content attained by this method was 42%, and the sugar present was mostly glucose. A newer enzyme-mediated process produces corn syrup with higher sugar content, most of it fructose. This product, high fructose corn syrup, whose sweetness matches that of sucrose, is cheaper than sugar obtained from sugarcane and sugar beets, and much loved by manufacturers who put immense quantities of it into soft drinks, juice, salad dressings, ketchup, jams, jellies, ice cream, and many other foods. Look at labels of sweetened foods and you will see high fructose corn syrup everywhere. I wonder about the metabolic effect of such a great increase in consumption of fructose, which is unprecedented in human history. The Food and Drug Administration considers high-fructose corn syrup innocuous because the body breaks sucrose down into glucose and fructose. In fact, however, the body does not handle large amounts of fructose well. You can maintain life with intravenous glucose, but not with intravenous fructose. Severe derangement of liver function results. There is also evidence that high intake of fructose elevates levels of circulating fats, serum triglycerides, increasing risks of disease of the heart and arteries. In some human populations, the disastrous effects of introducing refined and processed carbohydrates are obvious because they happen so rapidly. Two noteworthy examples are Native Hawaiians and Native Americans of the desert southwest of the United States. Polynesians are big people who traditionally view stored body fat as a positive attribute, in sharp contrast to the aesthetic of almost anorexic leanness that prevails in Europe and America today. Before contact with Western civilization, the Polynesians who settled the Hawaiian Islands were very active and largely free of the degenerative illnesses that plague them today. Their carbohydrate staples, all with low glycemic index ratings, were poi, the mildly fermented paste made from starchy taro roots, breadfruit, high in fiber and micronutrients, and sweet potatoes. They ate meat, pork especially, fish, shellfish, and other fruits and vegetables. Today they eat a great deal of American fast food, especially bread, rice, soda, snack foods, pastries, and candy. Their normal heaviness has blossomed into morbid obesity, accompanied by crippling rates of hypertension, adult-onset diabetes, and heart disease. In the American Southwest, a similar fate has befallen tribes like the Pimas and Oodham, peaceful agriculturalists whose traditional diet of beans, corn, squash, chilies, acorns, and starchy roots has been replaced by the worst offerings of the fast food and processed food industries, especially high GI carbohydrates. These Indians are now hugely fat, with up to 80% of the population suffering from adult-onset diabetes. Alarmingly, this disease has begun to appear in children, many of whom become morbidly obese early in grade school. Type 2 diabetes typically appears in middle age and has not previously been seen in children. These native peoples are particularly worthy of study because they are close relatives of the mountain Pima, the only Indians of the region to escape their fate. The mountain Pima live in remote mountains of the Mexican states of Sonora and Chihuahua and have not yet gained access to modern processed food. They remain lean, active, and free of the diseases of Western civilization, while their relatives from the same gene pool have ballooned into the fat, hypertensive, diabetic Indians who are now so numerous in southern Arizona and northern Mexico. Even more interesting, when researchers have put some of these Indians back on their traditional foods, the obesity, diabetes, and hypertension have reversed, suggesting that diet is the variable of paramount importance in causing the differences and pointing up the health benefits of unrefined, unprocessed, traditional starchy foods. Similar experiments with native Hawaiians have yielded similar results. Now, why should Southwest Indians and Hawaiians be so sensitive to the damaging effects of the modern American diet, especially its emphasis on high glycemic index carbohydrates? The likely reason is genetic. Type 2 diabetes is genetically controlled, but many genes are involved, and its inheritance is not straightforward. Some peoples, Native Americans, Gypsies, Eastern European Jews, for example, have these genes in high frequency, and often inherit a tendency to this disease. But the examples of the Hawaiians and Oodham tell us that an interplay of genetic and environmental factors is responsible for eliciting type 2 diabetes. It appears that it is possible to have the genes but not the disease as long as you avoid the environmental triggers. We know that obesity and sedentary lifestyle increase the risks of type 2 diabetes, presumably only in those people with a genetic susceptibility, and that weight loss and exercise will often cause the disease to recede to the point that no treatment is required. The conventional wisdom is that obesity causes insulin resistance. But might both insulin resistance and obesity be the results of a sensitivity to high GI carbohydrates? Carbohydrate sensitivity is a recently popular concept, given more credence by identification of a cluster of symptoms that may act as a marker for it. Called Syndrome X, or more accurately, Insulin Resistance Syndrome, and first identified by Gerald Reaven, now a professor emeritus at Stanford University School of Medicine. These symptoms include a tendency to store fat in the abdomen, high blood pressure, and elevated blood fats, serum triglycerides. People with these symptoms, like Hawaiians and Oodham, appear to be very sensitive to the disturbing effects of high GI carbohydrate foods on metabolism, and very prone to develop type 2 diabetes unless they switch to diets and lifestyles that cause this inherited tendency to recede. How prevalent is carbohydrate sensitivity? Some experts, like Reaven, estimate that 25% to 30% of the general population is very sensitive, and more of us are less so. Obviously, if you belong to certain ethnic groups, the risk is higher. Many people do not have this trait, but its prevalence raises another interesting question. Why should a genetic pattern so closely correlated with severe disease be so common in the world? Shouldn't natural selection have weeded such a detrimental trait out of the human gene pool? An answer that makes sense to me is that the trait has become detrimental only as the environment has changed, specifically as highly refined and processed carbohydrate foods have become so prominent in human diets in recent years. Before such foods were common, the genes producing carbohydrate sensitivity, insulin resistance, and type 2 diabetes may actually have been advantageous, especially in populations that did not have regular supplies of calorie-dense foods and that experienced hunger often and starvation sometimes. Some scientists call them thrifty genes because they give individuals enhanced ability to take advantage of food when it is available. If you have thrifty genes, you can more easily store up calories as fat, hedging against times when calories are not forthcoming. Thrifty genes become detrimental only when food is available all the time, and especially when much of that food is the kind that yields quick-release energy. If you are carbohydrate sensitive, what should you do about it? One strategy would be to stop eating carbohydrate foods altogether, and indeed, that is exactly the recommendation of some of the diet books that are currently so popular. But consider again the studies done with Hawaiians and Oodham. They were not put on a diet of high protein, high fat, and no carbohydrates. They were encouraged to eat their traditional low GI carbohydrate staples, poi, breadfruit, and sweet potatoes in the former case, and beans, squash, and corn in the latter. And with this change, their metabolic problems reversed. This is an important observation because it reinforces the idea that it is the kind of carbohydrate you eat that is critical, not whether you eat carbohydrate. Even people genetically programmed for insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes can be perfectly healthy on diets containing substantial amounts of filling, satisfying, unprocessed, unrefined, low glycemic index starchy foods. They may also be able to tolerate moderate amounts of low GI sweets, especially fruit. The most facile and pernicious distortion of the scientific evidence by anti-carbohydrate writers in popular books about diet, in fitness magazines, and in all manner of publications about health, is the suggestion that eating sugar and refined starch is the direct cause of insulin resistance and therefore of obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. This is simply false. Insulin resistance is mostly determined by genetics and strongly influenced by physical fitness and body weight. If you have the genes for it, you can prevent or slow its development by exercising regularly and sufficiently and by keeping weight in the normal range. We are certain to hear a lot more about insulin resistance in the coming years because it is now an exciting focus of nutritional research and medical concern. In the meantime, beware of writers and diet gurus who use it to justify their recommendations to eliminate or drastically reduce consumption of carbohydrate foods. While I reject the theories and nutritional philosophies of Atkins, Montagnac, and their adherents, I am very concerned about how much and what kinds of carbohydrate belong in the optimum diet, and how current patterns of carbohydrate consumption influence health. Most dietitians recommend that at least 50, and at most 60% of calories come from carbohydrates. But except for telling us to eat more complex carbohydrates and fewer simple ones, they have little else to say. I agree with the general percentages, which translate out to about 125 to 150 grams of carbohydrate a day for every 1,000 calories in your diet. A moderately active woman aged 18 to 54 would eat about 1,800 calories a day, of which 900 to 1,080 should come from carbohydrate, that is 225 to 270 grams of carbohydrate a day. Her male counterpart, needing about 2,300 calories a day, should get 1,150 to 1,380 carbohydrate calories, or 288 to 345 grams of carbohydrate a day. I also want to make these strong recommendations. The majority of carbohydrate calories should come from less refined, less processed foods with low glycemic index ratings. Processed foods tend to be unhealthy in several ways. They are low in fiber and other protective micronutrients, and often high in sodium and the wrong kinds of fat. So eating less of them is a good idea in general, as well as for any specific effect on carbohydrate metabolism. It is desirable to eat some low GI carbohydrate with most meals, such as whole grains, beans, vegetables, and low GI fruits, which are generally the temperate fruits like berries, apples, and cherries, as opposed to tropical ones like mangoes, papayas, and pineapples. If you eat high GI foods, eat them in moderate quantities and balance them by adding some low GI foods at the same meal. Reduce the impact of high GI foods by eating them as part of mixed meals, including fiber and acids such as lemon juice and vinegar, both of which slow down digestion. Minimize consumption of foods and beverages sweetened with high fructose corn syrup. These tend to be low quality foods, and you are better off using less of them. Also, do not use pure granulated fructose as a substitute for table sugar. Make an effort to replace white and whole wheat bread with dense, chewy, grainy breads whenever possible. Learn to like firmer cooked, al dente pasta rather than longer cooked. Eat more small, waxy, new potatoes and fewer large, floury potatoes. Eat more basmati and converted rice and less regular or sticky rice. Eat more beans. They are high-quality foods providing low GI carbohydrate along with other nutrients. These recommendations apply to all of us, but are especially important if you have symptoms of insulin resistance, adult-onset diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, elevated blood fats, serum lipids or triglycerides, or have a family history of these problems. Finally, although low-carbohydrate diets may work for short-term weight loss, they are not the healthiest strategy for losing weight, and I do not recommend them as an everyday way to eat. That does not mean that I endorse low-fat diets either. Those regimens present different problems, which I will explain in the next section. But first, I want to give you a bit more information about fats in general. We have such bad associations to the word fat these days that it is difficult even to think of positive usages. But a few linger on, such as Fat City as a term for a good place to be. I once heard a music critic aptly describe the beautiful melody of the third movement of Brahms' Double Concerto as fat and sunny. Most people in the Western world today regard body fat as something to get rid of, and the cultures who hold a different view, like Hawaiians, are fast disappearing. Gypsies also equate ample body fat with prosperity and happiness. They are decidedly out of the cultural mainstream in the countries they inhabit. Because it is the most calorie-dense of the macronutrients, fat has a very positive potential, especially for people facing scarcity. Think again of our Paleolithic ancestors, who certainly knew both feast and famine. When they killed and cooked large animals, the fat of the meat would have comprised the choicest cuts, providing them with caloric insurance against lean times ahead. I once visited a group of Inuit in the Canadian Arctic at the northern end of Baffin Island and watched them hunt seals and small whales and eat fresh blubber from the kills with the greatest delight. They simply cut it out of the carcasses and passed out portions to everyone present. The Inuit's love of fat, even raw, unadorned fat from marine mammals, is unique and probably necessary for their survival in a cold, harsh land. It is also a graphic example of the preference for fat we have inherited from our hunter-gatherer ancestors. The fact is that fat tastes good to us. It accounts for much of the flavor of food and also contributes to an all-important quality of mouthfeel that food technologists pay great attention to. Chocolate is appealing to so many of us in part because of the sensuous mouthfeel of cocoa butter. Indian cooks begin the preparation of most dishes by frying whole dried spices in clarified butter, ghee, to release their flavors. Many of the flavor components of spices and other foods are fat-soluble, and fat is the vehicle that conveys them to our taste buds. Most people find the combination of positive mouthfeel and concentration of flavor irresistible. When we describe food we like as rich, we are usually responding to the pleasure provided by its content of fat. Compare the experience of eating a handful of your favorite potato or corn chips to one of their fat-free counterparts. Can something we like so much be so bad for us? Is fat really the chief culprit in the modern diet, the cause of or main contributor to obesity, heart disease, and cancer? In my view, as is the case with carbohydrate, fat per se is not the problem. The problem is the kinds of fat that have become dominant in our diets. In order to explain why I hold that opinion, and to tell you how much of what kind of fat the optimum diet should contain, I must first give you some more background information about lipids, fats, oils, fatty acids, and compounds derived from them, how they exist in our bodies, how they move about, and what specialized functions they perform. Very little fat in the body exists as free fatty acids. Most fatty acids are hooked together, three at a time, onto a carrier molecule, glycerol. Glycerol is a simple compound of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen easily derived from the metabolic breakdown of glucose. Its three carbon atoms serve as a backbone to which fatty acid chains can be linked. These combinations are called triglycerides. The fat stored in our fat cells is in the form of triglycerides, as is most of the fat moving through the bloodstream. Triglycerides also comprise the main type of fat in food, accounting for 95% of the fat we eat. The outside carbons of a glycerol molecule prefer to hold saturated fatty acids, while the middle carbon prefers an unsaturated fatty acid, either mono- or polyunsaturated fatty acid. But this varies from food to food. Artificially hydrogenated fats, like vegetable shortening, which I will have a lot more to say about, have saturated fatty acids on all positions, while some seed oils have polyunsaturated fatty acids in all positions. Given the varying lengths and degrees of saturation of different fatty acid molecules and the three positions available for attachment, there are a great many possible permutations. All fats and oils are mostly mixtures of different triglycerides. When we eat them, the body frees the fatty acids from their glycerol carriers and rearranges them into new triglycerides for its own use. Stored triglycerides in the body's fatty tissues are primarily reserves of calories. To get to those calories, the body again separates the fatty acids, primarily the saturated and monounsaturated fatty acids, from glycerol and sends them to sites of cellular oxidation where they are burned for energy. Stored triglycerides are also reserves of essential fatty acids, the special polyunsaturated fatty acids needed for critically important structural and regulatory roles in the body. One of the most common medical diagnostic tests ordered today is the serum lipid profile to measure levels of fat and cholesterol in the blood. It includes a determination of serum triglycerides. High levels result from overeating, especially from eating too much refined carbohydrate with high glycemic index. High serum triglycerides are associated with increased risk of heart disease, especially in women, because they often signal abnormal lipid metabolism and arterial damage. Most of the serum lipid profile concerns cholesterol, a hard, waxy substance that occurs in many animal foods, especially meat, whole milk, and egg yolks, and is also made by the liver. Cholesterol performs vital functions in the body. It serves as the starting material for the synthesis of important hormones, sex hormones like estrogen and testosterone, and adrenal hormones such as cortisone that regulate metabolism. The body derives vitamin D, necessary for utilization of calcium, and makes bile acids from cholesterol. Bile acids aid the digestion of dietary fats by breaking them down into smaller particles, and the body can rid itself of excess cholesterol by adding it to bile that is secreted into the small intestine during digestion. Cholesterol is also a component of the secretions of oil glands that protect the skin from dehydration and other sorts of environmental irritation. Finally, cholesterol is vitally important as a modifier of the structure of cell membranes. Recall that cell membranes are mostly composed of lipids. The unsaturated essential fatty acids make membranes more flexible, while more saturated fatty acids make them stiffer. Day-to-day variations in the intake of fatty acids create a problem in maintaining flexibility of cell membranes within the narrow limits necessary for optimum health. The body uses cholesterol to compensate for these variations, adding more to stiffen membranes that are too fluid and removing some to soften ones that are too stiff. If cholesterol is important to the body in so many ways, why does it have such a bad reputation? The reason is that it is also the main component of arterial plaque, the hallmark of atherosclerosis, responsible for the stiffening and narrowing of arteries that lead to heart attacks, strokes, and other circulatory calamities. There is no question that atherosclerosis is pathological, that a disorder of cholesterol production and transport is central to it, and that it is a disease of modern urbanized society greatly influenced by diet. But many questions remain, among them just what dietary excesses or deficiencies cause cholesterol production and transport to go awry. I noted earlier that the liver makes cholesterol as a component of bile. The adrenal glands and sex glands make it to produce their hormones, and virtually all cells manufacture small amounts for their own membrane requirements. In order to make cholesterol, the body starts with the two carbon fragments, acetate fragments, produced by fatty acid oxidation, the breakdown and burning of fats as fuel. Since saturated fatty acids are the preferred fuel fats, saturated fatty acids are the main source of acetate fragments, but the burning of carbohydrates also produces them as intermediate products of metabolism before full transformation to carbon dioxide and water. Diets high in saturated fat and high glycemic index carbohydrates lead to increased production of acetate fragments in the body, and an excess of acetate fragments in most people drives production of cholesterol. I say most people because cholesterol production, like other aspects of metabolism, is also influenced by genetics. Some lucky people have inherited so-called Methuselah genes that keep them from producing excess cholesterol and developing atherosclerosis no matter how much saturated fat and refined carbohydrate they eat. We also get cholesterol from our food, in lesser or greater quantity, depending on the percentage of animal foods we eat. But cholesterol that we eat has a relatively slight influence on the serum lipid profile compared to the effect of saturated fat and refined sugars and starches. For years, egg producers have complained that eggs have gotten a bad rap in all the fuss about cholesterol, and they are right. Egg yolks contain cholesterol, but their inclusion in the diet makes an insignificant contribution to serum cholesterol. Besides, they can be an important source of the scarce essential fatty acids. Increased cholesterol production is only one part of the story of atherosclerosis. Equally important is the way this substance moves around the body. Triglycerides and cholesterol move through the blood together in protein-coated droplets called lipoproteins of varying size and function. Lipoproteins are transport vehicles made by the liver for conveying lipids to and from cells. When tiny fat droplets from the intestinal digestion of dietary fat enter the bloodstream after a meal, they are taken up by one class of lipoproteins called high-density lipoproteins, or HDL. HDL conveys triglycerides and cholesterol to the liver. The liver can metabolize them further, send them out to other parts of the body, or in the case of cholesterol, eliminate it in bile. If it sends them out, it does so in another class of transport vehicles called LDL, or low-density lipoproteins. You may have heard the terms good cholesterol and bad cholesterol applied to HDL and LDL. In fact, HDL and LDL are simply carriers or transport vehicles, not just for cholesterol, but also for triglycerides, and both are needed to move these substances around the body. All cells have specialized receptors for LDL on their membranes, docking sites where these transport vehicles can land to unload their cargo. In this way, cells get the fats and cholesterol they need for their functions. When those needs are met, the docks close, and excess fats and cholesterol continue to circulate as LDL in the blood until their contents are taken to fat cells for storage or transferred to HDL for return to the liver. High levels of LDL in the blood, low levels of HDL, and a low HDL to LDL ratio are all correlated with atherosclerosis and increased risk of heart attack. Genetic inheritance determines a great deal of our individual lipoprotein profile. Some unlucky persons having familial hyperlipidemias, high blood fats, that are not much influenced by diet, and the few lucky ones with Methuselah genes are able to clear fats and cholesterol from the blood efficiently, no matter what they eat. In most of us, eating a lot of the wrong fats and carbohydrates will elevate serum triglycerides and cholesterol, increase LDL transport of fats and cholesterol to tissues, and overwhelm the capacity of HDL to bring the excess back to the liver. In the form of LDL, cholesterol can damage the walls of arteries, but whether it does so or not depends on other factors. I will mention a few of them as a way of emphasizing that the whole story of atherosclerosis remains to be told. One possible factor is that some kind of damage to the walls of arteries must occur first in order for cholesterol to deposit there. More and more medical experts are coming to believe that the underlying problem is inflammation, caused by imbalances in the hormones that mediate the inflammatory response, or even by a bacterial infection. Some even suggest that the presence of cholesterol in arterial plaque represents a flawed healing response, an attempt by the body to repair defects in vessel walls. Another possibility is that some forms of cholesterol are directly damaging to arteries. Roving white blood cells gobble up oxidized cholesterol and thereby transform themselves into foam cells that attach to artery walls and may initiate a process of inflammation and degeneration. The susceptibility of cholesterol to oxidation is influenced by the nature of the fats that travel with it in LDL. For example, if your principal dietary fat is olive oil, your LDL will contain triglycerides rich in oleic acid, the monounsaturated fatty acid in olive oil. Traveling in that company, cholesterol is relatively protected from oxidation. So although the correlation between high serum LDL and heart disease risk is clear, as are the benefits of lowering serum LDL by drugs or lifestyle measures, the cause and effect sequence between high LDL cholesterol and atherosclerosis is not. In some circumstances, and in some individuals, high levels of so-called bad cholesterol may not cause damage. Given all this uncertainty, it is more than a little risky to blame diet alone for the epidemic of heart attacks in developed countries in this century. But it is important to look at a possible connection if we are trying to decide how much and what kind of fat we should eat. At the beginning of the century, death from heart attack was an uncommon event. It became all too common in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, felling many middle-aged men and postmenopausal women. The same pattern occurred in other industrialized countries, but generally was not seen in the Third World. Since the late 1960s, the epidemic of heart attacks has waned, for reasons as mysterious as those accounting for its rise. One possibility is that increased use of antibiotics has treated many unrecognized bacterial infections in human arteries. Another theory is that increased use of aspirin has given many people protection against the blood clots that are the immediate cause of coronary artery obstructions. Still other possibilities are the emergence of effective drug treatments for hypertension, a known risk factor for cardiovascular disease, and the decline in smoking among men. But many epidemiologists continue to look to dietary explanations for both the rise and fall of coronary heart disease in the 20th century. We can see that as people of other countries begin to eat the way we do, their rates of coronary heart disease go up. That is a clear pattern in contemporary Japan and China, for example. So there must be something about the Western diet that promotes arterial damage. It is tempting to think that the problem is saturated fat, especially in meat, milk, cream, ice cream, butter, and cheese, all foods absent from the traditional diets of China, Japan, and other Asian countries, where heart attacks were once rare to the point of being medical curiosities. But there must be more to the story, because Americans were eating a lot of saturated fat throughout the 19th century and the early years of the 20th century and not having heart attacks. They were also eating plenty of refined flour and sugar. What changed? Why didn't traditional Inuits suffer from coronary heart disease when they were eating so much animal fat? Some experts and all of the anti-fat camp tell us that the total amount of fat we eat is the main determinant of health and longevity. The higher the percentage of fat calories in the diet, the shorter the lifespan, and the greater the risks of disease in general, not just heart disease. But both research and epidemiological surveys fail to support this position. Science has established a direct correlation between saturated fat intake and LDL cholesterol in the blood. Most people who eat more saturated fat will have more LDL cholesterol, and unless they are protected by other factors, genetics, exercise, and aspirin among them, will have higher risks of cardiovascular disease. Science has established no such correlation for total fat intake and disease risks. If you look for those correlations in Europe today, you are in for some surprises, especially if you subscribe to the Ornish-Pritikin philosophy or the spa mentality that rules in many healthcare institutions. Scotland, with the highest intake of both total fat and saturated fat, has staggering rates of cardiovascular disease, just what you would expect. The latest contribution of Scotland to world cuisine is deep-fried Mars bars, candy bars dipped in batter, fried, and served as dessert in the fish and chip shops. But in parts of Italy and Spain, in Greece and on the island of Crete, people are eating comparable amounts of total fat and not dying of heart attacks at higher than expected rates. Cretans eat 40% of their calories as fat, which rivals Americans and Scots and are much healthier. The fats they eat are quite different, however. These observations draw attention to the possibility that the kinds of fat in the diet may be more important than total fat. Saturated fats can be unhealthy, but that may be true of other fats as well, and some fats might actually promote health. What I intend to do is look at distinctions between good and bad fats and changes in proportions of them in people's diets over the past century. As I do so, be aware that merely talking about good fats and bad fats raises the hackles of Ornish Pritikin followers who believe that fat always equates with bad. In the 1950s, when the scientific consensus was that saturated fat raises cholesterol levels and heart attack risks, doctors and dietitians began warning people away from beef, butter, cream, and cheese, and urging them to use polyunsaturated vegetable oils in the belief that these were heart healthy. This was the era of the skyrocketing popularity of margarine made from corn oil and booming sales of vegetable oils from a variety of sources, including cotton seeds and peanuts. Common sense seemed to support these recommendations in that saturated fats are solid or semi-solid at body temperature, whereas polyunsaturated oils are liquid. One would expect solid fats to leave sludgy residues and liquid oils to move freely in blood vessels. Unfortunately, common sense did not alert us to the dangers in the vegetable oils that have become so prevalent in our diets. To discuss those dangers, I must give you a bit more background on the chemistry of fats and oils. Recall that fatty acids are straight chains of carbon atoms with hydrogen atoms attached. One end of a fatty acid molecule, usually thought of as the beginning because synthesis begins there, is a methyl group, a carbon atom with three attached hydrogens. The other end is a carboxyl group, the oxygen-containing portion of the molecule that gives it a weakly acid nature. By convention, the carbon atoms of a fatty acid molecule are numbered beginning from the methyl end. Saturated fatty acids are identified very simply by specifying the number of carbons in the chain. Since no double bonds are present, the structure of the molecule is known. Thus, stearic acid, found in the fat of many animals, is designated in chemical shorthand as C18-0, meaning a fatty acid chain 18 carbons long with zero double bonds, hence a saturated fatty acid. In chemical notation, the presence of a double bond is indicated by the Greek letter omega, and its presence in the chain by the number of the first carbon atom that participates in it. Oleic acid, the main fatty acid in olive oil, is the same length as stearic acid, but contains one double bond between carbons 9 and 10. Therefore, it is designated C18-1-omega-9, a monounsaturated fatty acid, with one double bond, belonging to the omega-9 series, a small family of fatty acids with the first double bond in the 9-10 position. Linoleic acid, one of the essential fatty acids, is another C18 chain, but a polyunsaturated fatty acid with more than one double bond. In fact, with two double bonds, one in the 6-7 position, the other in the 9-10 position. It is C18-2-omega-6 in the omega-6 series, an important family that I will have much to say about. The other essential fatty acid, linolenic acid, is C18-3-omega-3. This shorthand name tells you that linolenic acid is an 18-carbon polyunsaturated fatty acid containing three double bonds, the first between carbons 3 and 4. Linolenic acid is therefore an omega-3 fatty acid. I have already told you about the importance of that family. When plants and animals synthesize fatty acids from glucose, they first make saturated fatty acids, adding two carbon units end to end until the desired chain length is reached and terminated with a carboxyl group. They can then use enzymes at particular positions of the chain to create monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fatty acids. But there is an important difference between these biological kingdoms with respect to fatty acid synthesis. While plants can insert double bonds near the beginnings of fatty acid chains, in the omega-3 and omega-6 positions, for example, animals cannot. Animals can put double bonds further down the line, but not up front. They lack the enzymes to do so. Yet they need both omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids for important functions and will become sick and even die without them. That is why linolenic and linoleic acids are essential. You must have them in your diet and have them regularly to live and be healthy. Wait a minute, you might say. I've told you that fish like salmon and sardines are important sources of omega-3 fatty acids and that egg yolks can provide essential fatty acids. Aren't fish and chickens members of the animal kingdom? Of course they are, and they cannot manufacture omega-3 fatty acids any more than we can. But they can eat them and store them. Salmon and sardines get them by eating algae and other simple forms of plant life that make omega-3s, then store them in their body fat. Chickens in the wild can find plant sources of omega-3s to put in the yolks of their eggs. When salmon and chickens are farmed, the omega-3 content of foods derived from them is determined by what they got to eat. Unless salmon farmers make an effort to provide dietary sources of omega-3s, the flesh of farmed salmon will be much inferior to that of wild salmon as a source of essential fatty acids. Chickens confined to cages eating standard feed will not produce eggs that have anywhere near the omega-3 content of eggs of free-range chickens that scratch and peck the ground for food. Recently, a new egg has appeared on the American market, one high in omega-3 fatty acids. Egg farmers get this result by fortifying chicken feed with a meal made from algae. In the same way, animals that eat plant sources of essential fatty acids, either directly or indirectly, fish, eggs, will have high levels of essential fatty acids in their body fat. Vegetarians tend to have significantly higher levels of stored essential fatty acids than meat eaters, for example. There is growing medical awareness that essential fatty acid deficiency may be widespread and very detrimental to both physical and mental well-being. We do not see in humans the full-blown deficiency syndromes that occur in experimental animals given no dietary essential fatty acids, but human diseases that may be caused or aggravated by relative essential fatty acid deficiency are very common and include atherosclerosis and coronary heart disease. One indirect piece of evidence that must be very upsetting to the anti-fat camp is a recent finding of the ongoing Harvard Nurses Health Study, established in 1976 to examine the relationship between diet and disease. Women in the study who regularly ate mayonnaise and oil-based salad dressings had greatly reduced risks of fatal coronary heart disease compared to women who ate those foods rarely. The researchers argue that mayonnaise and salad dressings can be sources of linolenic acid, the heart-protective essential fatty acid. Instead of talking about essential fatty acid deficiency, nutritionists should really focus on omega-3 deficiency, because linoleic acid, the omega-6 fatty acid, is plentiful, both in nature and in our diets. Not only is it in many seeds and nuts, it is in the oils expressed from them, including all of the polyunsaturated vegetable oils on the market, and it accumulates in the fat of some animals, especially pigs. On the other hand, linolenic acid, the parent omega-3 essential fatty acid, occurs only in a few seeds and nuts, flax, hemp, pumpkin, and walnuts, and fewer oils. Thus, many plants produce seeds full of omega-6 essential fatty acids, but very few have omega-3s there. Instead, omega-3 essential fatty acids abound in microscopic forms of plant life like algae. In higher plants, they tend to occur in leaves, although usually in low concentrations. Dark leafy greens also supply omega-3 essential fatty acids, again not in high concentration, but this may be one reason that cooked greens are a healthy addition to the diet. Wild grasses are another source of these necessary fats, and while we do not eat grass, we do consume the flesh of grazing animals that eat it in quantity. That brings us to an interesting consideration about how the modern diet has changed for the worse. Our Paleolithic ancestors ate a lot of foods of animal origin, including fish, fowl, and large mammals. The fat of these animals was full of essential fatty acids, especially omega-3 essential fatty acids from the grasses and other plants in their diets. Scientists interested in the virtues of the Paleolithic diet estimate that it provided the two classes of essential fatty acids, the omega-6 and the omega-3, in about equal proportions. Flesh foods in the modern diet are very different because so many animals raised for food today, including chickens, pigs, cows, and sheep, no longer graze in the wild. Instead, most are fattened with grains such as corn that provide linoleic acid, omega-6, but not linolenic acid, omega-3. Moreover, people take in a lot of their fat in the form of vegetable oils and products like margarine made from them. Most of these, again, provide omega-6 fatty acids, but not omega-3s. Estimates of the ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids in the modern diet are between 20 to 1 and 40 to 1, a huge change from what our distant ancestors ate. This may well have consequences for human health and longevity. I have said that the body must have both of these essential fatty acids on a regular basis. Once it has a fatty acid with a double bond in the 6-7 position, an omega-6, it can make other needed fatty acids in that series by changing the length of the chain or adding other double bonds down the line. It can do the same with a fatty acid containing a double bond in the 3-4 position, an omega-3. For instance, EPA, eicosapentaenoic acid, one of the key components of salmon and sardine oil that has a protective effect on the heart, can be made from linolenic acid. However, the body cannot make it if it has no starting material with a double bond in a 3-4 position. And even if it has the right starting material, it cannot make EPA if there are too many omega-6 fatty acids in the diet. The problem is that as the ratio of omega-6s to omega-3s increases, the efficiency of those omega-3s that are available declines because both types of fatty acids compete for the same limited supply of enzymes. Therefore, the ratio of omega-6s to omega-3s in the diet may strongly influence the behavior of essential fatty acids in the body. For one key function, the synthesis of prostaglandin hormones, that ratio appears to be critically important. It is beyond the scope of this program to detail the synthesis and effects of prostaglandins. Suffice it to say that they govern all cell growth and differentiation, blood clotting, and key aspects of immune function. Unlike insulin and other endocrine hormones, prostaglandins are not made in particular glands like the pancreas where they are stored until needed. Instead, all cells in the body, except red blood cells, synthesize them from essential fatty acids on demand for immediate release. A century ago, the Bayer Pharmaceutical Company in Germany invented aspirin, a semi-synthetic derivative of salicylic acid found naturally in willow bark. The new drug quickly established itself as an effective remedy for fever, pain, and inflammation. But for most of the past century, its mechanism of action was unknown. Aspirin has so many apparently unrelated effects on the body that no one could make sense of how it worked, until the discovery of prostaglandins. Aspirin modulates these hormones, and its myriad actions are mediated by them. Much more recently, doctors discovered that aspirin thins the blood, and began recommending that people take it every day to lower the risk of heart attack. Most doctors assume this prescription works by reducing the clotting tendency of the blood, so that even if coronary arteries are narrowed and roughened by atherosclerosis, blood clots are less likely to form in them. But some experts now suggest that the anti-inflammatory action of aspirin is the real explanation, assuming that atherosclerosis is fundamentally an inflammatory disorder of arteries. Meanwhile, daily low-dose aspirin also turns out to reduce risks of two serious diseases of the digestive tract, colon cancer and esophageal cancer. All of these benefits, and probably more, are the result of aspirin's effect on the synthesis and deployment of prostaglandins, suggesting, I think, how great their influence is on our health and well-being. There are many different prostaglandins in several different families, each with different actions, but here is a simplifying principle. In general, prostaglandins derived from omega-6 fatty acids promote cell proliferation, inflammation, and blood clotting, while those derived from omega-3 fatty acids oppose those effects. Again, both are necessary and must work together in concert to maintain health. Too few of the former would impair cell growth and differentiation, increase risk of bleeding, and result in failure to mount adequate immune responses. Too few of the latter might increase risks of cancer, blood clots, and inflammatory and autoimmune diseases. Mounting evidence suggests that dietary intake of essential fatty acids can affect this balance. Even if linolenic acid and omega-3 is present in the diet, a high omega-6 to omega-3 ratio blocks production of the inhibitory prostaglandins. It is certain that the modern Western diet is seriously deficient in omega-3 essential fatty acids. Moreover, that diet now provides a great excess of omega-6 essential fatty acids, mainly in polyunsaturated vegetable oils and products made from them, creating an omega-6 to omega-3 ratio vastly different from what most people enjoyed in the past. Widespread use of polyunsaturated vegetable oils is a dietary change that came with the 20th century. So is the modern practice of eating meat from animals raised on grains devoid of omega-3 essential fatty acids, instead of grasses containing them. Therefore, it is more than possible that the epidemic of coronary heart disease and fatal heart attacks that took place in the 20th century correlates not so much with any excesses in what people were consuming, but rather with deficiencies of protective factors that in the past neutralized the harmful effects of eating a lot of saturated fat and high glycemic index carbohydrates. As I mentioned earlier, beginning in the 1950s, doctors and nutritionists began urging people to eat polyunsaturated vegetable oils as antidotes to saturated fat and its unhealthy effect on LDL cholesterol. Most people who follow this advice, who replace butter with safflower oil or corn oil margarine, will see reductions in LDL cholesterol. But we now know that polyunsaturated oils also lower HDL cholesterol, the desirable fraction that represents the body's effort to remove cholesterol from tissues and blood and take it to the liver for elimination. So you now know of two problems associated with these oils. They lower good cholesterol along with bad, and they are the major cause of the unhealthy omega-6 to omega-3 ratio in our diets. But there is more. The double bonds that characterize polyunsaturated fatty acids are points of strain in fatty acid molecules, susceptible to attack by oxygen. When oxygen reacts with unsaturated fatty acids, the result is the formation of a range of dangerous compounds. Oxidized fat smells bad and tastes bad. It accounts for rancidity of fats and oils and of foods containing them, like nuts and products made from them, chips and baked goods. The more double bonds a fatty acid contains, the higher the percentage of polyunsaturated fatty acids in a given fat or oil, the greater the exposure to light, heat, and air, the greater the tendency toward oxidation and rancidity. Flax oil, an excellent source of linolenic acid as well as linoleic acid, is so unsaturated and therefore so reactive that it oxidizes very quickly on exposure to air, even at room temperature, becoming thicker and harder as it does. Under the name linseed oil, it is the basis of oil paints and furniture finishes because it goes on in liquid form, then dries to a hard finish. If you are unsure what rancid fat smells like, just sniff some linseed oil or oil paint. And if you detect anything similar in nuts, chips, flour, or baked goods you are tempted to eat, throw them out at once. Oxidized oils promote arterial damage, cancer, inflammation, degenerative disease, and premature aging of cells and tissues. How they do so involves the generation of free radicals, highly reactive molecules that can initiate chain reactions of chemical disruption.